You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. As President Bush used the anniversary of September 11th to claim progress in fighting the war on terror and possibly expand it beyond Iraq and Afghanistan, we're going to listen today on Peace Watch to more of the stories of people for whom the terrorist attacks not only provided a life-altering experience, but determined their roles as lifelong peacemakers. They're the mothers, wives, sisters, and brothers of people who were killed in the World Trade Center and the Pentagon 2 years ago, and they formed themselves into a group called September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. In the months following the attacks, Peace Watch producer Scott Gurian followed several members of this group as they took part in a walk for peace between Washington, D.C. and New York City. He also had the opportunity to sit down with Amber Amundson, Colleen Kelly, Phyllis Rodriguez, and David Petorti to listen to their stories. We present now the second part of an hour-long audio documentary he produced.
Once the bombing started, it was very, very difficult. It was a very sad day for me, and I just felt like, well, this cycle is just never going to stop, and when will this end? I guess I was angry about that, and really the thing that angers me most to this day about my brother's death is that he was there. You know, he shouldn't have been there. He didn't work there, and I keep waiting for the day that I'm going to wake up and I'm going to be really angry at something else or somebody else or the Taliban or whatever, and that, you know, maybe it will. Maybe tomorrow I'll wake up and feel that way. But today I don't feel that. I'm just angry that he was there, and I'm angry that this happened at all.
On the October 11th National Memorial Service for the Pentagon victims, it was very clear to me that our leaders were not able to provide a memorial and a remembrance. It was about retaliation, and I could understand what they were saying. They thought they were comforting the families, that we will wipe them out. In fact, they said, we will smoke them out of their holes. And I realized then how important it was for me to contact those leaders and let them know that I was not comfortable and not comforted by their angry words.
I remember when I was up in Ithaca, we eventually had a memorial service for them, and I drove my car to Jiffy Lube, you know, because it was a long trip, 700 miles back, and just watching the TV at the Jiffy Lube while you're waiting for the car to get done, and it was, CNN was on, and it was America's New War, you know, had the logo, and it was just, they were just promoting this war, like, you know, yeah, just overnight, suddenly we've just got this new product to sell, and everybody was so into it, and I was very upset. And it was so at odds with what I was experiencing with my family, because they were not crying out for blood, and my dad's a Marine, former Marine, and he was just very taciturn and very quiet, and my mom was very quiet, and my dad's Marine buddies, one of them that was on Iwo Jima with him, came over and brought them communion because he was now an assistant at the Catholic Church, and, you know, and these old vets were just so somber about this whole thing, and they weren't really happy to see war returning. It was like this horrible thing that they had fought and tried to get rid of, and now suddenly here it is coming back. I just got that feeling, you know, this awful monster that they had tried to rid the world of, and here it's swooping back in on us.
It just felt natural to me, and it was something I had to do, and I had to speak out. My motivation is our children, and I can't continue to create a life for them without doing something about what is going on. The only way I can bring peace to my children, my family, and honor Craig is to continue to speak the words that he would have I made a promise to him that I would continue for the rest of my life to speak out against war and retaliation, And it feels good to do that, and it's really the only thing I can do right now. And without doing that, I don't think I could even move forward at all.
A friend of mine teaches at a high school. He teaches a theology class and was speaking about the American response, the bombing in Afghanistan, and how he personally was against that and trying to talk to these high school students about that. And the kids were all saying to him, well, Mr. Carney, that's great for you to say, that's fine for you to say, but you didn't lose anybody in that, and you weren't personally affected. So my friend came to me and asked me how I felt about coming in to speak to his students. And that was really the first time I had spoken publicly about this. One, it felt like the right thing to do. Two, I work with high school students every day, so it felt like the best setting. I'm very comfortable with teenagers, and I love teenagers. And it felt like the right thing to do. And the kids were great. They all disagreed with me. I think out of five classes, I had one kid that even remotely remotely agreed. But they were willing to listen, and they were interested in what I had to say, and they did see the uniqueness of where I was in all this, I guess, and wanted to hear about it.
Having gone through this, having lost my brother, that's sort of like the worst thing that could possibly have happened, short of me dying, but then who would care? I wouldn't care. You know, and in a sense, I feel like I have nothing left to lose because I've already lost the most I could lose. And out of that, it's made me feel that I can't just sit around and feel sorry for myself and mourn in private and have my own private grief. Why don't I just go out? Why don't I say something and see what happens? Because I have nothing left to lose. And I really feel like that's the same mindset of the people who did this. They must have felt like they had nothing left to lose. You know, they were in such a desperate situation. Why don't we just do this heinous crime because we have nothing left to lose? And it's interesting that we both were feeling the same things, but they took down the World Trade Center, and I'm sort of pointing that energy towards the peace movement. So it just demonstrates that when you put people in that position, it can go either way. I feel like I'm putting my energy in a good direction, but I think it could just as easily go in a bad direction, and that's something to think about when we start dropping bombs indiscriminately all over the world. You know, something's going to come back, and we don't always know what it's going to be, or may not be what we expect it to be.
I think now the United States is finally seeing that the fear we have and the devastation we have, most people in the world have been dealing with for a long time. And we are now part of that. We're not excluded. I mean, I felt completely secure bringing children into this world and creating life with my husband and nurturing that and feeling safe because we were a country not under siege. And I think that has changed completely. We're now part of it. We now understand what it's like to have planes crashing into buildings and fires that last for 3 months and unidentified loved ones and children that are so confused and so scared. We have an understanding of that now, and I think we should look at what we can do to prevent further attacks on the United States and really consider whether or not military action is going to do that. Is it going to, you know, wipe out a certain population and then everything will be okay?
I think what I noticed right away is that everybody had flags out. And then I noticed that they just left them out. You know, they left them out all night, they left them out when it rained, and they were starting to get kind of beat up and dirty, and they had them all over their mailboxes, and they'd get all, you know, rained on and mud on them. And my dad, growing up, I remember my dad had this big flag, and he still has the same flag that he's always had. And he, you know, he would take it out and hang it up on the front porch on, like, the 4th of July and Veterans Day and, you know, certain holidays when you hang the flag up, like, you know, Lincoln's birthday and Washington's birthday, back when they had separate birthdays. And he was always very careful that, you know, you hung the flag up, and then when the sun went down, you went out and you got the flag and you folded it up and you put it back in its box and you put it back in the basement or wherever he had it. So, you know, that's how you do the flag. And there's actually a little diagram that comes with the flag. This is how you fold the flag. You fold it over and then you make it into like a triangle or something. And so he treated it very seriously, and he's a veteran, and, you know, that's the way you're supposed to do it. And when I saw people just leaving these flags out, you know, you'd have a flag in front of your house out there when it's raining and the flag's getting wet. That really just kind of affected me the wrong way. You know, I felt like these people just put it out there and they weren't being vigilant. You know, you just think that democracy is this thing you just sort of do. It's like, you know, you hand somebody money that comes to the door and says, okay, here, just take this and go away. But democracy is not something where you just hang something up. It's something you have to be vigilant about, and you have to pay attention to it every moment. You don't just do it and leave it and come back, you know, a month later and check on how it's going.
Elliot is 5 and Charlotte will be 3 this January. They're trying to piece the world together and trying to figure out what the American flag means, because it was part of Craig's military burial, and there was a flag light over his casket. And so for them, they are seeing the images in the flag, and that flag really represents their last physical moment with their father. Elliot, for example, waves flags in the air and says, "We want Daddy, we want Daddy." And he's really attached to the flag. And that's why this symbol is so important to me, because protesting this war and saying that you don't think it's a good idea does not mean that you don't look to that flag and feel love and feel security. And what the flag has always meant for me and now means for our children is something that's good, something that's their dad. They understand that their dad was a nonviolent person, and I want the flag to represent peace, civil liberties, freedom, all of the things that we've learned about that have gone into the very making of the symbol. And right now, I feel like it's not a representation of that, because we aren't embracing all of those qualities and those values that I feel are what it means to be an American. It's not anti-American to say no to this. It doesn't mean you don't love your country or the people who were killed. For me personally, it means that you truly do care and that you truly do want to see the United States be in a safe situation. I'm perpetually agonized that American people do not feel that it's okay to discuss this, to think of alternatives, and a lot of it goes back again to the American dream and what is freedom, and if you're patriotic, you support the military, and really allowing people to feel patriotic, to wear a flag, even if you are not comfortable with the war in Afghanistan, you know, to really realize we are all united, we are American, and part of that for me is being able to openly disagree with what is going on.
I agreed to appear on a drive time show on the West Coast, not knowing that it had the second largest listenership to Rush Limbaugh. That should have tipped me off when I heard that. It had two hosts, And they started off very respectful, and they wanted to know about Greg, and they wanted to know how we learned and stuff like this. But I think they also wanted me to be a weepy mother who wanted peace and couldn't defend herself, because they started to increase the intensity of their questions as I didn't knuckle under. And we ended up having this knockdown, drag-out discussion, which I kind of was happy about, because I started thinking about the millions of people in their cars and what they were going to be hearing. And they questioned my pacifism, and they used some of the old arguments, like if someone came in and was robbing you at gunpoint, you mean you wouldn't want to kill them, you know, and all these traps. So I was searching for arguments and things that would reach their listeners, because it was live. And they were talking about foreigners and about terrorists and this and that and the other. And of course I'm in favor of punishing terrorists and criminals. Of course I am. That's not the issue. So I told them that our country has a long history of experience with domestic terrorism. And I said, take the South before the Civil Rights Movement. I said, there was the KKK and then the White Citizens Council. And I said, where African American people were systematically and without any due process murdered, raped, their houses burned, run out of town. And I said, what good would it have done for us to advise Southern blacks to arm themselves and go out and kill the white guys who killed their family members? I said, what would that have accomplished? Or was Martin Luther King's approach better? Was it more productive in the long run?
My brother Jim had his picture in the New York Times. I don't know if you see the New York Times, but they've been running pictures of all the victims, every victim, I don't know, however many thousands there are. And so every day they run maybe a dozen faces with a little paragraph about them. And I was thinking how different it would be if everybody who's died in a war, whether in Central America or in Iraq or in Afghanistan right now, if we could see all of their pictures and have a little paragraph about each one, because all of those people are somebody's father, somebody's mother, somebody's sister, brother.
On the day that my brother's portrait was published, the flip side of that was portraits of Afghanis. Someone, I guess one of the Times reporters, had found an old camera, or one of the kids in the streets had an old camera, was just taking pictures of Afghani person. So, you know, on one side of the paper you have Americans and who had lost their lives on September 11th, and a little bit about what their life and their living was all about. And on the back side of that paper were these portraits of Afghani people and what their lives have been for the past 20 and 30 years and what they've lived through. It was quite striking, the difference between the two.
There's no difference between them and us, you know. We say us versus them, but there is no us versus them. There's only us, and we're all us. I don't particularly feel like an American right now, and I don't say that to be anti-American or anything like that, but I just feel like I'm part of this community of victims, that I have something in common with people that have suffered in the same way all over the world. And that's not something that has divisions of nationality or race. You know, we're all in this together. You're either down here when the bombs fall, or you're up there. And it doesn't really matter if you're down here who's dropping the bombs, because you're still down here and you're still dying.
David Pitori lost his brother in the World Trade Center, and I had an opportunity to walk with him past Ground Zero. It was the first time he had been there since this September 11th attack. And it was extremely difficult, because I know how that feels, to go to a site and know that your loved one is there or was there. When I looked into his eyes, there was a connection there, because I asked him how he was feeling, and he said, I think the same way you felt when you saw the Pentagon. And so being with him on that walk past that
mass destruction really motivated me again. I walked past and thought, there's no way we can stop speaking out against this. There's absolutely no way.
It was bad. It was bad. We took the ferry from Staten Island. That's how we got into Manhattan. And, you know, I started crying on the ferry when we came over because you just look at that skyline. This is the first time I've been back to Manhattan in 5 years. And you just look at that skyline and it's like, you know, it's gone. It's this big hole. It was pretty hard. And the other hard thing was just to be in the middle of all these people that were shopping. And I don't know how to describe it, just all these people just coming at us. You know, we were kind of going in the opposite direction from all the shoppers, and they just didn't seem to care at all. You know, they weren't being contemplative. They didn't seem somber. I mean, maybe it's been a few months. Maybe it was different at the beginning, but it was very hard to take because it was like, you know, don't you people know what just happened here? You know, how can you just go back to buying CDs on the street again? So I felt bad personally, and I also felt bad to be among all those people because there was a feeling of, I feel like I'm being very judgmental here, but just this feeling that they still don't get it. You know, they're still sort of living in denial. And if you really got what happened on September 11th, you're not walking around buying CDs. You know, you're doing something else.
My view of the world is not changed remarkably. I mean, I feel like I've always thought that there was great evil in the world, but I've always felt that for every great evil, there was just innumerable singular acts of kindness and goodness that happen every single day that outweigh evil immensely. So my view of the world has not changed. What has changed is that my brother happened to be involved in one of those great, great acts of evil. And hence my family's now involved in that.
I will find ways to continue to speak out and say that I'm not comfortable with this and include my children in that so that they can be part of something that we're doing to remember their dad, because we were part of a military community and we have a lot of friends that are in the military, and letting Charlotte and Elliot know that we do not want any more daddies to be gone. And I think that we sometimes dismiss children and think that they're not capable of understanding the concepts of peace and war. And I think when a child can say, oh, mommy, is this plane going to crash into a building? If they can conceptualize that from what they've seen on September 11th, then I think they can conceptualize what it would be like to have peace in our world and to have peace in our country. And, you know, asking children, we were able to speak with elementary students at a school and asking them, what are some other solutions? What do you think? It's amazing. I was completely surprised at the level of critical thinking that was coming from a fourth grade child who was able to say, wait a minute, mom and dad have taught me that you don't fight to get what you want, so I don't understand why we're fighting. And shouldn't we just communicate with them? And for them, it seems so obvious. And I really listened to this particular child and looked at her and realized that she's making a lot of sense, and that on some levels it seems very elementary. It seems simple. And, you know, like she said, I think communication is key, were her words. And I looked at her and I thought, wow, yeah, you're right.
Margaret Mead, who was an anthropologist, said, never doubt that a small group of committed people can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has. And when you think of September 11th, a small group of committed individuals changed the world. You know, a couple guys with knives got on airplanes and took down buildings, killed my brother, killed thousands of other people, and it was just a small group of people. And I think the challenge facing us in our community, our spiritual community, is can we, as a small group of people, change the world just the way they did, except change it to make the world better, perhaps change our country's foreign policy, and bring people together instead of just going on to kill them.
You know, I understand families of victims and just plain people on the street being angry and latching on to the patriotism and the call to arms and let's get them and all this. I can understand it because everyone's angry and frightened. And it's still very new. And it's very new for us as a nation. I think what's more important is what happens when the dust settles and people start to say, hey, wait a minute, did that improve it? When they start to question.
I really feel like we just can't go on this way. I feel like we're either going to get our act together or we're not going to be around anymore. I really do feel that very deeply. And I think, gee, how am I going to get along, you know, with this having happened in my life? And then there are other times when I think, we may not even be here this Christmas, you know, or this New Year's. Who can say, you know, we're unleashing these forces in the world and anything can happen overnight. The world can change again. So I feel very calm because I realize that we either have to get our act together or there's not going to be any more world. And so I'm kind of thinking about my soul right now. I'm not worried about getting anthrax, and I'm not buying Cipro, and I'm not buying gas masks. I'm trying to polish up my soul, because the soul is the only thing you take with you when you die. And as Don Henley says, there's no hearses with luggage racks, you know. And so I don't really care what happens to my body or if the world blows up, because I realize I really have to get my soul together.
David Pertorti's brother Jim worked in the World Trade Center. Amber Amundsen's husband, Craig Scott Amundsen, worked in the Pentagon. And Colleen Kelly's brother Billy was attending a morning business meeting in the World Trade Center's Windows on the World restaurant on September 11, 2001. Amber, Phyllis, David, and Colleen are members of the group September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. They spoke with Peace Watch producer Scott Gurian. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias, and our engineer is T from the Pattersons, taking the train to Tibet. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Adel Hamid of KPFA, Mark Torres of the Pacifica Radio Archives, Matt Bradley, Sam Husseini, and Kelsey Diltz. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.